employees are fearful of discussing anything that may call into question the safe operations of that pipeline.
A leaked report on the work environment at Alyeska Pipeline Company. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 2nd of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the changing face of private business in Alaska.
It's the largest number we've ever seen for new companies that have come onto the list.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
An internal report commissioned by Alyeska Pipeline Company officials has been leaked to the online news organization Truth Out. The report was prompted by an email to BP's ombudsman. BP is majority owner of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. The report detailed multiple concerns ranging from the tyrannical nature of retiring CEO Kevin Hostler to maintenance neglect and mismanagement. The author of the email is reportedly a senior official with Alyeska, but remained anonymous, using Afraid a Leak as an online name. The report was written by two attorneys with the international law firm Morgan, Lewis & Bocius. Jason Leopold is deputy editor at Truthout, who reported on the document's findings. He says in the report, employees describe Hostler's management style as vulgar.
The five vice presidents have used words such as inappropriate, demeaning, to describe his behavior. In fact, the investigation conducted by Charles Thibault, Washington, D.C. attorney, said that Kevin Hostler's behavior violated Alyeska's own code of conduct. His behavior has contributed to extremely low morale and an environment where employees are fearful of discussing anything that may call into question the safe operations of that pipeline.
How did employees say he handled safety issues that they raised with him?
In his own defense, Kevin Hostler said that he does get very angry if he believes that safety is being compromised, if an unsafe work environment is being created. And employees just laughed at that. And they said, that's just outrageous, because they do want to bring up safety concerns. They do want to speak about it openly. They fear retaliation. The executives don't want to raise those concerns because they fear being dressed down by Kevin Hostler and perhaps losing their jobs. And so, you know, the report did not say Kevin Hostler addresses safety concerns. Kevin Hostler said he does. Employees found that to be laughable. They said that neither Kevin Hostler nor BP want any money invested, if they can help it, in the pipeline. They're looking to, you know, save as much money as possible.
The report also brings up budget cuts in recent years that have deferred important maintenance on the pipeline. Describe that section of the report and the ultimate conclusion.
It said that it could confirm that in some of these areas there were budget cuts and that the work was deferred, but it did not find that it threatened the integrity of the pipeline. But it did say that there is a bow wave. There is a bow wave of deferred projects, and it needs to be addressed because two things could happen. In the future, it will only become more expensive to deal with those issues. And secondly, it could result in an environmental disaster, perhaps not on the scale of Deepwater Horizon, but certainly large enough to get people's attention.
You quote an anonymous BP official who describes the TAPS line as a ticking time bomb. How did he or she back up that statement?
Sure. Well, this official is someone who is referred to as a master root cause specialist. And I had shared with this person copies of several reports. The first report that I shared with this person was this very lengthy report by Charles Thibeau and his colleague, Jane Deeker, who were hired by Alyeska to investigate these concerns, as well as a report, an internal report that was recently completed by Alyeska into the spill that took place this past May at Pump Station 9, resulting in 4,500 barrels of oil being spilled, as well as forcing the pipeline to be shut down for 3 days. So he looked at the report, felt that between the past incidents that took place, along with this current incident, the findings, the fact that nothing has changed, that the company did not learn from its past mistakes, was systemic of a larger problem that this person felt was widespread, and noted that Congress, Department of Transportation, and the public needs to pay close attention.
Jason Leopold is a reporter with Truth Out. Links to the article are at our website, aprn.org. Three people are presumed dead in yesterday's plane crash in Denali National Park. The National Transportation Safety Board reports two pilots and a passenger are known to have been on board the Fairchild C-123 cargo plane, which went down in the park entrance area in good weather. NTSB investigator Clint Johnson says several people saw the mid-afternoon crash.
Multiple witnesses in the area indicated that the airplane did pretty much a roll and then nosedived into the tundra from there.
Johnson says the twin-engine Fairchild registered to Delta Junction-based All West Freight was loaded with construction equipment and headed from Palmer to Unalakleet when it went down. The vintage plane impacted the south slope of Mount Healy, within a mile of Denali National Park headquarters, about 200 yards north of the park road. But Park Service spokeswoman Chris Pfister says no one on the ground was hurt in the crash.
It is just fortunate that the crash took place in between two trails. It was in about a half a mile from our seasonal housing area, so there certainly were a fair number of people in the vicinity, so it's very fortunate that at least no one on the ground was hurt.
Pfister says accounts and photos from numerous people who saw the plane go down do not point to anything that explains the accident. The crash started a wildfire that was contained at about an acre. The park road remains open, but two area trails were closed temporarily. A National Transportation Safety Board official has arrived on scene. All West is owned by Bill Michael, who has operated the cargo business from his own airfield south of Delta since 2003. 9 Alaska businesses joined the list of the state's 100 biggest private sector employers in 2009, and the newcomers include a gold mining operation in the interior. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Only 2 years after it started production, the Pogo Mine near Delta has broken into the State Department of Labor's list of the 100 biggest private sector employers in Alaska. Pogo, which employs about 300 people, was one of 9 businesses statewide to break into the list. The gold mining and processing operation came in at number 97 on the top 100 list, which was published in the State Labor Department's July issue of Alaska Economic Trends. Neil Freed, a department economist who co-wrote the study, said the 9 newcomers are the most added to the list in the 23 years that the State Labor Department has compiled it.
Yeah, it is a lot. It's the largest number we've ever seen for new companies that have come onto the list.
Freed says it's significant because that's a lot of newcomers for a relatively slack year economically. But he says 2009 wasn't so bad in Alaska, at least compared to the rest of the country.
If we were to compare ourselves to the rest of the country or most other states, we still, of course, came out smelling like roses. So, I mean, from a relative standpoint, relative to the rest of the country, we did very well. Relative to previous years, we did slow down more than we have in quite a while.
Freed says the economic slowdown probably accounts for why there was no change at the top of the list of biggest private sector employers over the previous year. Like in 2008, Providence Health and Services in Anchorage again led the list in 2009. Government dominated the top five spots on the state's overall list, including, in this order, military agencies, other non-military federal agencies, the state of Alaska, the University of Alaska, and the Anchorage School District. Freed says government has been the biggest employer for decades here in Alaska, but private sector companies are starting to constitute a bigger slice of the state's economic pie.
The public sector certainly it remains very important in Alaska's economy and more important in Alaska than most other places for a variety of reasons.
In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Forest Service takes on climate change in Alaska and the rest of the country.
Some of the more severe impacts we're already seeing, so it's time that we got even more organized nationally.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
After many delays and with much anticipation from the fishing industry, the National Marine Fisheries Service just released its draft biological opinion on Alaska's stellar sea lion population. The draft clocks in at more than 800 pages of text, charts, and graphs, and it examines the effect of commercial fishing on this protected species. It also makes some recommendations that could limit fishing in a portion of the Aleutians. The western stock of sea lions was listed as endangered in 1990, and every year, NOAA scientists do surveys of the marine mammals to figure out how many are surviving and how many are breeding. And through most of the Aleutians, the numbers have stabilized, except for out at the western tip. There, the adult population has declined by nearly half in the past decade. It's this region that NIMS wants to target. NIMS says that while the population is influenced by a number of factors, commercial fishing does have an impact on stellar sea lions, and it negatively affects their habitat. John Warrenchuk is a scientist with the nonprofit conservation group Oceana. He agrees with NIMS' assessment that competition for food is a serious problem for the sea lions.
Stellar sea lions, they need abundant fish, abundant prey near shore to be able to do well. And they're kind of in the same boat with Alaskan fishing communities that need lots of fish near their communities to go out and catch. What we need to do is increase the biomass of pollock, of Pacific cod, and Atka mackerel in near shore areas in sea lions' critical habitat to make sure there's enough fish to go around.
And so NIMS is recommending placing some restrictions on fisheries in the western Aleutians. The draft calls for the closure of Atka mackerel and Pacific cod fisheries out near Attu, where the stellar sea lion population is most vulnerable. There would also be some limits on the groundfish fishery near the Andrianov Islands, but their restrictions wouldn't be as extreme. Dave Benton, head of the Marine Conservation Alliance, a fishery management organization, says that he's not sure these closures would necessarily be warranted.
I'm really not convinced that the scientific underpinnings are there to extend fishery management measures beyond critical habitat. It seems to me that there's a pretty steep bar that needs to be climbed over to get to that place. And I'm very curious when we look at the analysis to see how they base their decision to do that.
He says he's also worried that NIMS is moving too quickly with the proposal.
This thing warrants a very careful scientific review and very thoughtful public comment, and I don't see how we're going to be able to do that in the time frame that NIMS has specified.
Meanwhile, Warrenchuk has his own reservations about the direction of the plan, but for different reasons.
It is a step in the right direction, but it's not all the way there. You know, overall, in Alaska, we need to move towards a more ecosystem-based fisheries management, which includes accounting for the needs of the ecosystem and for other components that rely on fish, including marine mammals and stellar sea lions.
NIMS will be accepting public comment on the draft plan until August 27th. The final draft of the biological opinion on stellar sea lions is scheduled to be released in January. The state of Alaska has established a Southeast State Forest, setting aside just over 25,000 acres of state lands for timber harvests. The parcels are spread over a wide area, but most are located on Prince of Wales Island. KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports.
Governor Parnell recently signed legislation establishing the Southeast State Forest at the Viking Sawmill in Klawock. He called the legislation a first step in revitalizing the timber industry and expanding wood energy in Southeast Alaska. The lands included in the forest are already set aside for timber harvest. State Forester Chris Mache says a forest designation ensures that lands will be available for timber harvests into the future.
It really didn't change how the lands were being used. It just provides legislative designation, which then makes it feasible for us to invest in long-term management on those lands, because we know that we'll own those in the future, as opposed to potentially having them classified for some other type of use or even selected as part of a formation of a burl process.
Mache says that means that the state can continue to invest in what he calls aggressive pre-commercial thinning to foster quicker maturity of second growth timber.
The main purpose of putting these lands in the state forest was to provide a reliable and stable timber base for the processing industry in Southeast Alaska.
He says the allowable harvest on the approximately 25,000-acre forest would be about 10 million board feet a year. The Southeast State Forest will provide only a small portion of what is necessary to maintain the region's dwindling timber industry. For instance, Mache says Klawock's Viking Mill needs 20 to 25 million board feet to operate a single shift annually. There are approximately 49,000 acres of state land set aside for timber harvests in Southeast, about half of which were included in the state forest.
At some point in the future, we may propose to add those additional acres into the state forest, but at least in our discussions with Division Mining, Land and Water, this is what everyone was comfortable with in terms of proceeding with this particular bill at this time.
The Southeast Alaska Conservation Council opposed the location of some of the lands included in the forest. SEAC Conservation Director Rob Cadmus.
There are areas that are used by people in nearby communities or are important to fish and wildlife habitat. Probably the best example is the Crittenden Creek parcel near Wrangell. It's located right next to Miller Creek State Park, and it's used by folks in Wrangell. And the Southeast Alaska State Forest is really going to be managed for timber, but a parcel like Crittenden Creek really needs to be managed for the people who use it, and the fish and wildlife.
Cadmus says SEAC is also concerned about logging practices on state lands.
Although this act does offer some protections, it's not as good at protecting fish and wildlife habitat what's done on with the standards and guidelines for logging on national forest lands. So we definitely like to see some increases in things like stream buffers that will help protect our salmon and the fish and wildlife, which are the foundation of our unique Alaskan way of life.
Cadmus says SEAC would also like some guarantees to ensure that state timber is processed in the region rather than shipped out in the round. Alaska Forest Association Executive Director Owen Graham says a new state forest won't solve the timber industry's woes.
The latest addition to the state forest won't have any immediate impact on the timber industry, but I think it's a good thing that they've enlarged the size of the forest.
Graham says harvests on state lands have kept the region's timber industry afloat as Forest Service timber sales remain tied up in federal courts. As for the state's management of its timber sales, Graham says there are plenty of environmental protections in place.
And I think the state does an excellent job of managing their timber lands and protecting all the non-timber resources, and they follow the laws.
The Southeast State Forest is Alaska's third state forest. There is also a state-managed forest in Haines and in the Tanana Valley. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
The U.S. Forest Service is bracing for the mounting effects of climate change, and Alaska is at the forefront of its efforts to adapt. The agency came out with a national roadmap for responding to climate change last month, complete with a 5-year plan to make forests more resilient. Beth Pendleton, the regional forester for Alaska based in Juneau, says while some forests are already taking stock of changes, the roadmap gets everyone on the same page.
Alaska is sort of the place where we're really noticing some huge changes relative to climate. Everything from warming oceans to melting glaciers to some of the effects on wildlife and fish. And the roadmap is really a national effort to bring some organization and some accountability to the work that the Forest Service as a whole across all of our programs is doing in a more, more organized fashion.
Pendleton says employees at Alaska's two national forests, the Tongass and the Chugach, have already been documenting the effects of climate change. She says the first step is assessing what changes are taking place and what the long-term impacts will be. Then they'll have to prioritize how they should respond to the change that's occurring. The Forest Service climate change advisor in Washington, Dr. David Cleaves, says Alaska faces particular problems.
One of the big issues in Alaska has been yellow cedar decline, and it's very closely or very strongly linked to climate change. So they will be trying to manage the forests by thinning them and looking for new, more adaptive genetic material that would be more resistant to climate change out into the future.
Cleaves says changes in the types of trees means changes to the forest as a whole.
We're seeing forest actually leaning because of the permafrost in the soil loosening up and the shallow root systems kind of giving way. So some of the more severe impacts we're already seeing. So it's time that we got even more organized nationally.
Cleaves says the roadmap includes a scorecard rating system all forest managers will use to see how they're doing. It looks at how employees are being trained and educated about climate change and what kind of outreach they're doing. Chugach National Forest spokeswoman Sarah Borio in Anchorage says they're already focused on trying to work with scientists and others to figure out how to cope.
One really clear example is we are working with the University of Alaska Anchorage to co-host a Chugach Climate Symposium in 2011. That is really going to help us get our arms around this, convene all the researchers that are working on our landscape studying climate, whether it's scientific or sociological.
The roadmap also calls for trying to curb pollution emissions, which scientists say is a contributor to climate change. While the greenhouse gases from all over the world can affect U.S. forests, officials say they still want to at least cut down on waste and pollution on the forest lands. Both the Tongass and Chugach forests are trying to green their operations to be less wasteful of water and other resources at facilities, even if it only makes a small dent in overall U.S. consumption and pollution. A world-famous archaeologist and Egyptologist was in Sitka this weekend for the 7th annual Paths Across the Pacific Conference. KCAW's Shady Grove Oliver spoke with Dr. Donald Ryan about his life and work.
Yes, this story does have a part about mummies and the discovery of a long-lost pharaoh's tomb, but we'll get to that later. So if you've ever wondered what it would be like to be Indiana Jones, well, that's great. But as Dr. Ryan told me, being a real-life Egyptologist is much more interesting than just a movie.
Probably the most famous archaeologist in the world is a cartoon. And that's kind of sad. But I'd like to say that, what myself and other archaeologists do is far more exciting in that movie, because we're real and he's not.
When he decided to do his famous 1990 dig, he chose places that were somewhat smaller.
Lying here and there in the Valley of the Kings are these little pits and little shafts, and they're small tombs. And some of them are just a shaft with a single room at the bottom of it, completely undecorated. And they were kind of mystery tombs.
One of the most well-known tombs he rediscovered and excavated was KV-60, or King's Valley, Tomb Number 60. And he found it in quite an unexpected way.
So we had a list of tombs we proposed to the Egyptian antiquities officials, and they approved these tombs. There were six. And one of them we put on our list, but we really didn't know where it was. But we knew it was out there, and it had been given the number years ago, Tomb 60. But we thought maybe in our spare time we'd go take a look in the area and see if we could find it. Well, as it turned out, to make a long story short, we ended up finding this long-lost Tomb 60 on our very first day of work in less than a half hour using a broom.
And with that broom, Ryan and his crew swept away the dust that had been hiding one of the most intriguing and sought-after tombs in the valley.
So we opened this tomb, and it's a crudely carved tomb. It's got stairs going down it in a corridor that's just littered with 3,000-year-old plus broken-up pieces of coffin and such. And then we get into the burial chamber, and there's a spectacularly preserved female mummy on the floor, striking what we usually identify as a royal female pose of that era, with his bent left arm. And an Egyptologist decades before had suggested if Tomb 60 were ever to be rediscovered, perhaps the long-lost mummy of the famous female pharaoh Hatshepsut might be found in this tomb.
But it wasn't so easy. Ryan said the tomb had no decorations on the walls, and all of the burial goods had been destroyed. They had no way to prove the mummy that they had found was really the pharaoh, until an unlikely discovery.
When Dr. Zahi Hawass, who's the head of antiquities, and his Egyptian team brought the mummy to Cairo, and they examined it, and a few objects associated with Hatshepsut's burial that had survived, and in a very, very strange situation, they were able to identify it. They had this wooden box with Hatshepsut's name on it that had some of her internal organs in it. They call these things a canopic box, or sometimes they're in jars. And they CAT scanned this thing, and they found something very rare and unusual in it. They found a broken tooth. And they had a number of mummies, including the one from Tomb 60, that were possible candidates for the mummy of Hatshepsut. And they CAT scanned all of them. And in the mummy that we had rediscovered in Tomb 60, it was missing a tooth, a certain tooth. It had a broken off root. And the tooth found in the canopic box matched it like Cinderella's slipper.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, and Shady Grove Oliver in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.